Greetings, Analog Explorer fans. This episode is a crossover episode from my alter octopus podcasting ego over at Deep Sea Magazine's Made Under Pressure podcast. But given today's guest and their background and all of the topics that we covered, yes, including watches towards the end, it's very much an Analog Explorer. And with that, on with the show. Greetings from the deeps, everyone. I'm your host, AJ Barce, and you've tuned into the Made Under Pressure podcast, a content extension of Deep Sea Magazine, and brought to you by me, the Analog Explorer. As a photographer, this episode's a pretty special one for me. I get to have a conversation with Christina Mittermeier, world-renowned conservation photographer whose work seamlessly connects the world of indigenous peoples, wildlife, diving, and photography. In her career, she became a trailblazer in the field of conservation photography, known for her compelling images that highlight the beauty of nature and the importance of protecting it. Now, I first discovered Christina's work in my earliest days as a professional photographer and her unique portraiture in photographing indigenous peoples around the world. In it, you can see the storytelling, the through line that Christina brings to all of her imagery of the dualities or the interconnectivity that we have between our cultural past, the earth, and the impacts of a continuously changing world. And it's in her ability to show interconnectivity that led us to dive into the second part of the show. She has been a National Geographic contributing photographer, taking some of the most breathtaking images above and below the water. And again, showcasing the interconnectivity or the duality that even wildlife have between Earth and our impact to it. What I want to emphasize is that Christina's work is a powerful bridge between conservation, exploration, diving, and storytelling. And really, it is through her work that you can see her hope in emphasizing the importance of the place that we all have to share in a way that raises awareness about environmental issues as a way to inspire and empower all of us. It is my privilege and honor to introduce Christina Mittermeier, a friend of ours in the deep sea community, but more importantly, using diving and photography as a method to show hope in humankind's ability to connect with the earth and how photography is a powerful tool in storytelling made under pressure. Well, Christina, thank you so much for making time for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
No, the honor is honestly mine. I have followed your travels and expeditions for decades at this point. First off, what I like to ask anybody who comes on the show that has such a wide career arc as you is, because like you are an environmentalist, you're a conservationist, you're a photographer, you're like me, you're a parent, you're a mom, okay? When you go and introduce yourself, like how do you first identify yourself? Like, hi, I'm Christina, I'm
a photographer, you know, but I think before I'm a photographer, I'm an environmentalist. And just people that, you know, it's like having leprosy. Once you say you're an environmentalist, they don't want to be friends with you. So I lead with I'm a photographer.
I'm married to an environmentalist. So I understand in conversations I've had with my wife. So here's the thing. Like I on-ramped with your work years ago because of your work with First Nations, Indigenous peoples around the world. Okay. And your photography is specifically your style. When it works with people, you have this essence where any shot of yours, you feel like there's like an unspoken connection there and such. And I'm curious, like, where did you find that element? Like, how is it that you can blend in so well wherever you go?
You know, it's funny, and I've asked myself this question a lot until recently, because I have indigenous heritage in myself too, but I look white because the majority of my heritage is European. Mm-hmm. And so there's this aspect of having this invisible part of you that you want to make visible. And for a lot of indigenous people today, you know, they don't look like the romanticized version we have in our minds, you know, of the Edward Curtis photographs of the chief with the feathers. They don't. They look like normal people that go to work as well. But there's an aspect of being indigenous that is about the spirituality of it, the connection to the earth, the connection to community. It's about, you know, the ritual, the tradition, the language that's also invisible. So I feel that pain, and I want my photographs to make the invisible visible, to return people you know, and when I photograph Indigenous people, I oftentimes ask them, you know, how do you want to be photographed? Mm. Not my romantic version of it, you know, so don't put any feathers or paint that you would normally do. But if that's something that would return your power to you and make you feel seen and proud, then that's how we do it.
That's amazing. Yeah, no, that was one of the first things that I noticed early on in my career as a photographer is, you know, I was working in Indian country and here in the Pacific Northwest. And it's interesting because like, what most people think of like American Indians, that picture doesn't really exist up here. We don't have teepees. We have longhouses. You know, there's Siawan. There's these smokehouses. There's these other traditions and such that link us a lot to the water, which is where we're going to go with, especially with you being an environmentalist and being a founder in Sea Legacy and such. In your trajectory, how did you go from like photographing people and then all of a sudden there's this love of the ocean and the environment? And what came first, like the photography or the ocean or both?
I think it's all of it has always been there. And I believe, and you're a parent, that every child that's born on this planet is born with this curiosity and love of animals and nature. And somehow it is our school system and our parenting that beats it out of children, you know? For a lot of us, don't be an artist. Nature will never feed you. Don't be a biologist. You know, so I think for me, it came from, I always had it. And I had parents that allowed me to read anything I wanted. So I read a couple of things in my early years that one of them terrified me, The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich. You know, as a young person, it just scared me to think that planet Earth is going to run out of resources and humanity is going to starve. And the second was just these adventure books, so very descriptive scenes of the ocean and the jungle and animals and adventure. And I always was fascinated by that. Huh. And so I think I always had it. And the path to getting to do what I do today was just the zigzagging between what I love, what I'm good at, what pays the bills, and you know what's good for the world. And so your ikigai, right? And just trying to find where the confluence of all of those things come together.
Well, it's funny that you bring up ikigai, because like I also see like a little bit of kaizen in your arc as well, like this incremental growth and change and making, I don't want to say making better, but like your, what I see in your early days of portraiture with Indigenous people, I also see reflected when you photograph wildlife. Like there's this, I'll say it's an iconic shot. You have this iconic shot of like this partially breaching like orca, you know, which is very, very connected close to us up here in the Pacific Northwest, because our orca pods are, you know, within our Indigenous people's cultures and tradition, like those are their relations. And so there's that image where you can just, I mean, the eye, it's a portrait no differently than I would see of you working with Indigenous peoples. And that's why I find it interesting. How is it, or what is your approach when, because I'm also a diver. So like, I know wildlife don't pose. And like you just said, you don't ask a person to pose any more than they would in their real life. So how did you find this, I'll call it a superpower. Like, how is this your superpower?
It's funny that you mentioned that. And it's true. You know, I often think of myself, I am a portrait photographer. Mm-hmm. And I'm making portraits of these creatures and trying to give them importance and give them, you know, personhood. Because why not, right? And for Indigenous people, all of these relations, I mean, if you talk to Reuben George, who's the Sundance chief of the Tsleil-Waututh First Nation, he will say, we are all made of the same material than our ancestors, you know, the raven, the rock, the bear, the mountain. It's this relationship that is connected to Earth in a very different way than the Western mindset of exploitation. And I think that's what makes things different. Mm-hmm. And people feel like they're part of spaceship Earth, and the rest of the people feel like they're just the users of Earth. But yeah, trying to make portraits, and wildlife doesn't pose. But I am trying. You know, as a photographer, you shoot millions of photographs, and then you scroll through your Lightroom looking for the moment when something looks like a connection.
Right. Having what you, the photography catalog that you have, like you must have like millions of bajillions at this point. Is there a situation or a photo that you've learned the most from? Like, was there a situation that you had where it did not go right, and what did you take away from that?
You know, I think the only photographs that we end up regretting are the ones that we don't take. Mm. Those are the ones, you know, where something gets away that you knew you could have done something with. And for me, there's been many moments like that, but photographing the Kayapo people way at the beginning of my career, when I was sent on assignment to kind of try to call attention to the plight of a people that was about to lose the river, the plans to create a mega dam in their territory was going to displace people. They were going to have to be moving to the cities, you know, the same tragedy we've seen unfold in so many places, so many times. And I was a coward. You know, I was so new to photography that I just didn't want to insert myself and be on the face of people. I thought it was insulting somehow. You know, I was making kind of like the predictable photographs that a photographer makes to please your editor, right? So everything is in focus, everything is properly exposed. But it was the dramatic images that were going to probably have more impact. And I had the opportunity to photograph this woman that had lost her baby. And she was in so much pain that she dug out the body of the baby from where it had been buried. And she was carrying it around. And she had a machete and she was hitting her head. And there was blood and dirt everywhere. And she was crying. And I just couldn't bring myself to interrupting her grieving with a photograph, right? So I didn't photograph her. And then I've regretted it all these years, thinking if that image had made it to the front page of a newspaper, you know, people probably would have been horrified and shocked to the point of reading what's happening and maybe react. I don't know. You can change the world with photographs, but only if you have the courage to take them.
Agreed. Agreed. Now, one of the things which dovetails into kind of my last kind of segment into more of the indigenous side of things is when I was working in Indian country, I learned a lot of the times I was on assignment just like you. I would be doing video and I would be doing photography. This was before we had the podcast. But one of the things that I had to learn kind of quick was there's a moment where those moments that you have to capture for, of course, your front page and such. But there's also, because within the cultural ties of the oral tradition, you have to bear witness. And did you ever find yourself in kind of juxtaposing that where that regret that you had? Has there ever been a moment where you kind of stood to bear witness, to be culturally sensitive and just saying, you know, my lens on this case is just going to go down here because I have to pay homage to what this culture is? What would be, can you share one of those stories where you deliberately chose not to take the shot because of that?
You know, you're so sensitive because you have been part of these, you know, belonging and being invited into the intimate spaces where Indigenous people hold ceremony and ritual. And as an outsider, it's a privilege to be invited to those places. And one of the first things you learn is that white people talk a lot, you know, and Indigenous people listen. And the first thing you need to learn is to shut up, you know, and listen. Whether you're understanding what's happening or not. And there are moments that are almost unspoken. You know, it's almost embarrassing when somebody has to tell you to stop shooting because you didn't realize that the importance of something. And, you know, I've seen things that, you know, that should not be photographed. You know, when somebody dies in battle, for example, and you immediately sense the heaviness of what just happened in front of you. And I saw this in the Omo Valley in Ethiopia, where they were two tribes were warring over, you know, oftentimes the scarcity of resources. Mm-hmm. You know, when biodiversity goes missing, you know, people go hungry and they war over resources, and they were hitting each other with sticks and somebody died. You can immediately sense that that's not for you to photograph, you know?
Mm-hmm. I do.
Things like that. But the more you spend time with Indigenous people, the more you start just listening to the things that are not spoken.
Agreed. So I want to pivot a little bit. Actually, I guess one last thing. Technology-wise, I mean, you come from the early days of document photography, bringing hundreds of rolls of film, I'm guessing. What was the first camera that you had that you're just like, this is the best tool ever? What was that body?
You know, I don't have favorite cameras because I'm not a techie. Oh. I will say this, you know, the less disruptive photography becomes, the better. Ah. So coming from the to, you know, the I shoot Sony mirrorless silent cameras that people don't even know you're shooting. Mm-hmm. you know, because you don't want to interrupt what's happening with your disruptive equipment. So yeah, invisible, being a fly on the wall, that's the best camera.
I love it. I love it. So let me pivot to the environmental side of things. I wanted to start off with the human side, because without the human story, like without having that concept of who you are, and this is my interpretation of you, without knowing that part of you, the second part kind of doesn't come into real focus for me, because really the reason why we're all worried about the planet is because we're humans. Like, Earth's gonna Earth, right?
Earth's gonna Earth. I love that.
Earth's gonna Earth. It is fact. There's a story I tell my son, and he's 7, because we hike and we trek. He's climbed several of our little summits and such. And I always tell him that the mountains are our eldest elders. And that's because long before there was anything, there was the mountains in some various form. It always was there. So Earth's gonna Earth. When it comes to your environmental side of things, you know, when did diving come into all of this perspective for you? It had to have been at a young age.
I went to university to study. I wanted to be a marine biologist, but they didn't have that in Mexico at the time. That's kind of like a luxurious science pursuit, right? Mexico, as a developing nation, had a bigger emphasis on fisheries and aquaculture. You know, how are we going to feed people? And so that's what I studied in university. And part of the curriculum was learning how to dive. So I became certified diver in 1987. And I did a NAWI certification. And I don't even think NAWI exists anymore, but it's more of a military-style diving training that happens over a course of 4 months. And so it's curriculum and diving and theory. And so I come from, you know, dive tables of planning dives on paper a long time ago.
Yeah, no, I understand. My father, I come from a diver dad. So my dad used to be an instructor, and he was NAWI, as well as YMCA back in the day when YMCA used to do scuba as well. So I grew up listening to all of his stories. And then, you know, when I grew up, and if I ever grow up, I'm just a lost boy, really. A regular Peter Pan here. But, you know, it's one of those things where you hear all the stories and stuff. And my dad would talk about the kelp forests, and he would talk about the abalone, especially because he was a California diver. And it's fascinating to, you know, hear the stories. And then now I'm a dad. Here I am also, you know, a dive master. And my son goes out and dives with me and such. And it's interesting because you being a mom, like, were you diving as a mom as well? Like, how does being a parent and being an explorer and photographer and diver, like, how do you juggle? How did you juggle all that?
So for 20 years, I was married to a terrestrial biologist. My ex-husband was a primatologist. So I shifted focus really from diving in the ocean to running around jungles and photographing indigenous people. So for 20 years, I barely put my head underwater. You know, it was just not accessible to me. I lived in Washington, D.C., where I am today. And I had this little tribe of children. You know, it's not so easy for me to peel myself away to go diving. Maybe as a result, my children are not very oceanic. You know, they all know how to dive, but none of them love it. They don't love, you know, being on boats and stuff. But it was not until I met Paul Nicklin, you know, that all of a sudden, you know, here I had a partner who is the biggest diver. And all of a sudden, diving was, you know, it's part of our relationship. So for the last 15 years that I've been with Paul, we've been diving, and I've done thousands of dives. And it took me a while. I mean, to be honest with you, it's not easy when I first started dating Paul, you know, to like, oh, of course I know how to dive. I'm now we certified. I have a PADI advanced, whatever. If you haven't done it for a while, it was really intimidating, you know, and it took a while for it to become the second nature thing that it is today.
Oh, completely. And so, like, let's preface, like, you guys are diving not normal diving condition. Like, you're in the Arctic. Like, I remember a shoot that you did, and you and Paul both were doing of the sea lions and stuff, like the iconic, like, sea lion.
Leopard seals.
Leopard seals, sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So Paul and I have done a lot of scuba diving, but, you know, I'm going to do, and this may be the blog post to do this. So I divide my experience in the water into three parts. You know, 30% of what we do is snorkeling. And if you want to be a camera person in the water, first skill is you have to be a superb snorkeler. You know, and there's no shame in being a fantastic snorkeler. And then you develop your free diving skills, which are also incredibly important for photography and filmmaking. Then you become a scuba diver. And, you know, again, being a competent water person is not just about understanding how much air is in your tank. It's, you know, what are the currents doing? What are the tides doing? What, you know, what are the what are the animals doing? And then just in the last few years, we switched to rebreathers. And so now we are a rebreather team on board of Sea Legacy One. So now you incorporate pure oxygen into the mix and a whole other skill set. And so, yeah, we spend a lot of time in the water.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize you guys were closed circuit. What rebreather systems are you guys on?
So Paul's been doing rebreather diving for 20 years, and he's done Inspiration, he's done Kiss. You know, we trained in Poseidon and didn't like it. So now we've switched to Revo, which we're both loving.
Oh, right. Oh, I didn't realize that. I've always seen you guys on open circuit. So I didn't realize, but I guess that makes sense because most environmental photographers usually go on rebreather because it's bubbleless and presumably is it actually true? Like, I mean, I feel like you're the one person I could get a straight answer from. Does it matter that you don't have bubbles? Does that help with photography and working with wildlife? Really?
You know, I think you have to eliminate your ego as a diver in order to answer that question. And the answer is some animals love bubbles. You know, yeah. I was just in New Zealand filming and we purposely had a scuba diver with us because kingfish will come to bubbles. You know, they will vortex around the bubbles. But a lot of animals in the underwater kingdom, you know, bubbles are usually a sign of threat. If an animal bubbles at you, watch out. And so, especially for fish that are, you know, the smaller reef fish, bubbles also carry sound, and that's scary. So it's like an invisibility cloak. You know, you will be invisible to creatures like sharks, you know, who all of a sudden can't detect that there's a diver nearby. And, you know, you want them to come closer. Sea turtles, you want them to come closer. So you just have to gauge what is it that you're photographing. And sometimes it's useful and sometimes it's not.
Fascinating. Yeah, no, I've been always curious of CCR and SCR and stuff. And it's just, you know, I don't know, like my brain, even though I am a techie guy, for me, like I like the essence of diving where I'm connected. Like obviously I'm a cold water diver, so I'm in a dry suit 9 times out of 10, but I still have a thick wetsuit. I love my 9mm Hollis, but like, I love the essence of being you're connected when you're underwater. Like, and I imagine you understand this, like, once that pressure hits you, you feel immediately connected more so than almost any other kind of adventure that you can be on. It doesn't matter if you're taking a pretty picture or just going on a fun dive. There's this hush that happens.
Yeah, I'll say this, you know, in terms of being connected, yes. And if the purpose of diving is to be connected to the environment, then leave the camera behind because, you know, you have to hyper-focus on so many things and these tunneling vision that happens to some people, especially on CCR, you know, you have to be monitoring your partial pressure of oxygen at all depths. And, you know, it happened to us the other day where we got peeled off a rock where we were holding on for dear life and there was a downwell, and there's nothing more terrifying than a current all of a sudden taking you down fast. And you're on CCR and you're watching your partial pressure of oxygen, you know, rise beyond your control. So yeah, that eliminates all the zen of connection. Because another thing happens when you feel that pressure and the silence comes, you know, you have a moment when you're like, oh, I'm part of the food chain now.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
And you're kind of like so vulnerable in that environment. Mm. And it feels amazing to me to be part of something bigger.
When it comes to your diving and stuff, there was an interview, and you have to forgive me, I can't remember where I heard it, but I believe Paul mentioned that there was a dive that kind of went wrong and he was kind of concerned about you. And I don't know that backstory. Can you share what happened?
Diving is an inherently dangerous activity. I think people that get in trouble are the people that, you know, start treating it casually. And there's a bravado in diving, you know, where anybody's a diver and they feel like, I don't know. I am a very conservative diver because, like, you know, I've done thousands of dives. You know, you have your close calls. And the dive that Paul was referring to, it, you know, and this is a word of advice to everybody, it was with borrowed equipment. Mm. So we were in Antarctica and for some reason there was something wrong with my dry suit and I borrowed a dry suit from somebody else. And all of a sudden, you know, everything that's familiar is new and you don't know where your purge is or how your, you know, equipment is going to function. And I the air went to the wrong place in the suit and it was pinning me face down and I couldn't breathe. So I panicked. So yeah, borrowing equipment all of a sudden makes you a foreigner in your own set of skills. And I was panicking because I couldn't write myself up. And everybody expects you to be an expert diver. So nobody was realizing that I was in trouble.
Right.
And I was trying to make eye contact with Paul, who was already going down, to say, I'm in trouble, you know, and I can't write myself and I'm getting pinned. I mean, it's just scary. Mm. Yeah. And he saw my eyes and he came and helped me.
Right. Well, as any good dive partner or buddy would do, you know.
And then eliminate the ego and the bravado from this to say, you know what, I need to call this dive. And Paul and I have an unwritten rule. You know, anybody does this, it's no questions asked immediately. Anything.
No, I agree. My regular dive partner and I, like, we, it's almost like having a dance partner. Like, it's the only thing I can, for those that are non-divers, because divers and non-divers alike listen to the show. And it's interesting because, like, the only thing I can equate it to is having a really good dance partner, and except your life's on the line. Like, you know, if something goes wrong, even if it's the something minor, equalization issues, or, you know, your gear fouls, you know, being able to just read in all black, because why can we have not any other color, apparently, or just in all black, and have to catch a micro expression that is behind a mask saying, like, nope. Yeah. There was a time that my dive partner and I got narked really bad. We were doing a deep diver at about 120, and I just, nope, we got to go up. And he was just like, oh, let's go up. We were on a shore dive. Let's follow the curve. I'm like, no, we're going up in the column. Like, something's wrong. And, you know, we hit topside and everything was, you know, 5x5. But again, it was no questions asked. It's just like, we weren't bumped. It just, that's the inherent risk of this.
People die, you know?
And yes.
They die on the stupidest things. And, you know, there's no bravado in dying, you know? Mm-hmm. It's just like, you don't get to dive anymore.
Yeah.
So no, we call dives all the time and for all reasons. You know, a lot of times it's the camera equipment that fails, and you know, you're descending and you realize that your strobes are not working. Well, what's the point of diving? You know, we call the dive, we go back on board, and then we dive again. I think we are incredibly lucky because we have all the dive support that we want on Sea Legacy One, so we can dive all day, every day, many times a day. So we don't have that pressure of, oh my God, I paid $100 and yeah, I need to dive my head off. But yeah, so you need to learn how to say, this is not feeling good and I need to call the dive.
No, I think that's the most important skill that you can have as a diver or as a photog, you know, is, you know, it. No, if I can paraphrase you, no photograph is worth dying for.
And you don't get to dive when you're dead, so.
No, you don't. That's the sad part. I know you said you're not a techie, which kind of surprises me.
So I know the technology, but I take no joy in talking about it or teaching it, but I know the technology, so shoot.
Oh, no doubt. Okay, so what I have to ask is, you know, whenever I've seen you shoot across your career, you almost seem like almost unapologetic but with using your equipment, or I, better yet, you're very demanding of your gear. I even seem to remember there's a clip of you, and I can't remember where or how far back it was, but like you're crossing a river or whatnot, and you have your equipment, and you know, boom, you accidentally, you know, you take a dive into the river and stuff, and your gear is completely soaked, or the gear that you had on you was completely soaked. And I'm just curious, with everything and everywhere that you've been, technology aside, like just the cameras that you use and the equipment that you have to bring with you, being in these locations, I mean, that's got to be like an inherent risk, hazard of the job, as it were. You've had to have wrecked gear, I mean, by accident. You know, like what instances have you actually destroyed gear in getting the shot?
You know, I am careful with my equipment because I respect a lot, you know, I'm so privileged that Sony has been sponsoring me now for 15 years. And so if I need a camera, they will send me one, but I don't destroy equipment on, again, bravado, but I've destroyed some equipment. I have fallen in the water. I have, you know, my assistant has dropped equipment in the water. And then we did something really stupid once in Monterey Bay where we saw an entangled whale and we thought we should help it. You know, and the lesson here is if you see an entangled creature, don't try to be a hero. We didn't know. And we tried to lasso it with a line that it was dragging and it almost killed us. You know, we tied it to our dinghy and then it wanted to dive. And so it wants to take your dinghy with you, you know, and you realize that last second that this enormous animal can, of course, take your dinghy. And so before it was about to dive, you know, it started thrashing its fluke right in front of our dinghy. And I just saw this mountain of water, you know, drench everything. So yeah, don't be hero. yeah, but, you know, taking care of your equipment is so important because it doesn't often die immediately. It will die in the middle of a shoot. Mm. And you're like, oh, it's because I drenched it last week. So, yeah.
So when you're on Sea Legacy, some of the things I've seen in footage is that it looks like you guys, because you are a Sony artisan, Sony bodies, and it looks like Nauticam housing. Is mm-hmm. that kind yeah, of your standard
so,
setup?
Yeah, absolutely. So Sony has been incredibly generous to both Paul and I and to the Sea Legacy team. And they often want us to shoot with the latest and the greatest and give them feedback. You know, that's one of my favorite things about Sony, that for many years they've used me as the ergonomical proxy for women, you know, which is great. And so they give us cameras, they give us funding, they support our storytelling. Nauticam, not so much. You know, Nauticam doesn't give us anything even with a discount, but they make the best housing, so.
Yeah. What strobe setups do you guys use?
So I experiment a lot with strobes, you know, and right now I'm shooting with Ike lights, which I love. They are incredibly efficient at recycling, and the type of light that they put is a clean light, it's beautiful beam. But because we're a mixed team of video and photography, I'm always in trouble for, you know, having my strobes in the footage. And so lately, now that I'm doing more rebreather and I can get a little closer to the fish, I'm experimenting with a continuous light system and I'm using Keldon lights.
Oh, wow. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Just to see what, and I know that it's not ideal, of course, you know, that it's the light from a strobe is always cleaner, but I just, you know, I'm out, you know, they don't let me dive or they want me to turn my strobes off. So if I can master the continuous light.
That's cool. No, I've been playing around with continuous light too. And largely because for me, I find it's a lot lighter, especially when diving and such. And I don't know, it's just, I mean, I dive emerald green water. So like our visibility is going to be a whopping 15, 20 feet oh. if I'm lucky.
Black scatter is a problem, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a huge problem. I was diving up north, actually, in north of Vancouver, and there's a wreck up there called the Annapolis. It was a destroyer that they sank. And, you know, I go down with just simply my GoPro because when it's funny because like a lot of people ask me, you know, when you dive, why don't you bring your big Sonys or whatever? And it's like, because I'm there to dive. I want to take it in. And I kind of feel like when it comes to that type of thing, like just a simple GoPro and a couple of lights on an armature and go, you know, I can share it with my son. I can share it with my dad because he can no longer dive, you know, and I feel like but backscatter is just a pain. And I'm just curious, because you're going to continuous light, you're using continuous lighting, like how do you mitigate backscatter when you have non-optimal conditions for viz?
So I have not experienced non-optimal, yes. I mean, the continuous light idea has really been recent.
Okay.
And it's been made a reality because of the rebreather. You know, I can get a lot closer and, you know, animals just come really close. And when that continuous light hits the subject, you're like, holy shit, that's beautiful. So now so this is recent. And we were diving in New Zealand recently, and there was a little bit of green water and backscatter, but for the most part, it was pretty clear. Huh. Now we're heading to the tropics. So I'm hoping to find a lot of, you know, available light. And I'm hoping, I mean, I don't know. I love a rear sink flash. And so I am still, my intention is to become such a good rebreather diver, as I'm a scuba diver, that I can dive solo. But at this point with my rebreather journey, I don't feel 100% confident yet. So I want to have a body. And if that's my desire, then I need to shoot continuously.
To segue a little bit into your current project, I want to talk about your book that's at the time of this recording, you know, you got like a Kickstarter and something. It's called Hope. Tell me everything behind the scenes.
So I'll tell you what, you know, because I've been doing photography so long, I've published before. And I am an artist before I'm anything else. And so having artistic control of my book is really important to me. And I knew that if I went with a traditional publishing house, that was going to be really difficult. It's happened to me before, where, you know, then you're at the mercy of an editor and a designer. So this company, Hemeria, approached me and they had this idea of the crowdfunding. And I thought this is innovative for a couple of reasons. First of all, I have 100% artistic control and it's going to be the monograph I want, not the one the publisher wants. And secondly, if I can break a ceiling for my fellow photographers and find a new way that we can publish, you know, where you don't have to be the most famous, you don't have to be Franz Lanting, you know, to have a book. But if you can crowdfund for your own project, then all of us can publish. And how cool is that? You know, you just have to put in the work to promote it. So we are at 65%. And there was a moment, it's actually more than a moment, you know, Paul and I tend to feed on each other for our optimism, but also on the hopelessness. And because we're on the front lines, like so many divers, you know, we get to see what the hell is happening and it's devastating. And it feels a little hopeless sometimes. And so I wanted to find reasons to remain hopeful. And I started documenting those reasons. And it usually is found in the words and the deeds of other people in other organizations and heroes in the front lines. You know, there's so many people around the world doing things that make us hopeful. So I wanted to dig into that and use my voice to help others feel hopeful. So this book is just the first step. I am looking for a corporate partner that's going to want to not just publish a book because that's easy, but to have an exhibition, I want to have a platform, like a web platform where we can showcase, you know, the reasons for hope, the projects around the world, from the people that are feeding the Palestine victims in Gaza to people that are working on solutions to climate change, or, you know, feeding the homeless in Colombia. I don't know. There's so many reasons for hope that we all can participate in and feel more hopeful. So that's my dream, but it starts with a book.
Oh, I love that. I did a small crowdfunding of that's how the Analog Explorer got created. Is my son had a lot of medical issues when he was first born, and as an artist, I was totally drained because I was dad 100% and then work 100%, and my art kind of had to go to the wayside, and so I needed a reboot, and that's how the Analog Explorer happened. And I put it out there, and it was a small book. And, you know, the community around me here in Bellingham supported me and funded it within like an hour. And I was just totally taken aback. And it
amazing.
Yeah. And it was refreshing for me. But also it kind of helped me, you know, gain a little bit of more hope for my son being healthy and healthy and all that other jazz. So I can empathize with you with, you know, especially when it comes to the earth, this is kind of, I don't want to say it's our child, but like, this is, you know, we only have one spaceship earth, right? You know? And I can understand how a lot of people who are environmentalists, they feel, hopeless, but at the same time, also, I feel like especially within the narrative of your photography, those that may not be fully environmentalist or maybe not fully, engaged with what that means. I feel like just in the snippets that I've seen of what's going into your book, you know, I feel like that can bring some people into the fold and kind of, I'm hoping, here's my hope, that your project is kind of a bridge for both communities, those that are environmentalists and maybe environmental and curious. Because I don't know about you, when it comes to environmentalism, immediately like activism comes in or the political side of it kind of comes in. Do you feel like your project Hope is going to be a bridge?
Yeah, I don't want it to be political at all. You know, I just want it to be a recognition of what you just said, that you know, we are traveling alone in the galaxy on our little tiny spaceship, and the only people we can count on is each other. So we'll either support each other to carry on, or we're going to kill each other and kill our planet. And it's just a reminder that, you know, I want to be able to count on others, and I want others to count on me. I'm going to do everything I can to keep the little spaceship thriving. And I don't want to, like when we created Sea Legacy in the beginning, I didn't want to be one of those confrontational environmentalists. You'll never see me at the Louvre destroying artwork of arts to call attention. There's got to be other ways that we can appeal to our human best side to say, you know, we depend on each other.
Awesome. And thank you. So part of the Analog Explorer is that whenever I interview somebody, there's usually a connection to time and horology. And I've noticed throughout a lot of clips, there's watches on your wrist. And I noticed that there's one on today as well. Is that a Rolex Yachtmaster? What's on wrist today?
It is a Rolex. You know, I'm not a camera techie or a dive techie. I'm also not a watch techie.
Yet.
But I'm... incredibly lucky because Rolex has this amazing initiative called the Perpetual Planet, where they support a handful of people to build these narratives of perpetual, you know, survivability on Earth, very focused on the ocean. And I am just incredibly lucky that they picked me up as one of their Perpetual Planet ambassadors. And that means that I'm now part of a family of explorers and environmentalists, if you want, that are supported by Rolex. And so they gifted me a Yachtmaster, which is beautiful. I like it because it doesn't have the traditional wristband. It has a...
It's on the rubber, yeah.
Goes very well with my diving. So I hate taking my watch off for diving. And they support me with funding as well. And they fund some of our storytelling. So very lucky.
Yeah, no, Alex Honnold actually runs the podcast or is the host of the podcast for the Rolex Perpetual.
He's interviewed me, yeah.
Yeah, that's super cool. I didn't realize that you were part of the Project Perpetual. Because I just noticed, so my son and I, because my son loves everything Nat Geo, I'm going to fully disclose that. He was excited that I'm talking to somebody who's, you know, been on National Geographic, by the way, 7-year-old, you know, we watched the photographer on Nat Geo last night.
It?
Oh yeah, he loved it. He up until like, so full disclosure, my son, probably in like 20 years, he's gonna like look back at everything we've done, all the hiking and all the adventuring that we've done. One of his like role models, if I can call him that, he loves Albert Lin. You know, that's kind of his jam. But I showed him that episode with you and Paul, and he thought that was cool because you guys are divers and trying to help the planet. And it's like you said, kids, when we're first born, like we're curious and we're explorers, and there's almost like an innate, like my kid's an outdoor kid. Trust me, at around 5 o'clock when he comes in, he smells like the outdoors. He's an outdoor kid.
That's a good smell.
Right. Getting back to your watch, I got sidetracked. No, I noticed when we were watching that episode, you had like a Rolex Daytona on. And so I was just like, well, that's curious. I was wondering if are you a watch collector, or is it just because of your connection with Rolex?
No. So that Rolex Daytona, which is my favorite watch, was given to me as a gift by a friend of ours who's very good friends with the CEO of Rolex. And he invited Paul and I to his birthday in Antarctica. And so we went with this amazing, he's a great philanthropist. He supports a lot of conservation work. And he gifted me that Daytona with a map of Antarctica engraved in the watch. So I love it. It's my favorite watch. But I had an e-bike accident a year and a half ago. You know, it's one of those things where I was being cocky and I didn't wear a helmet, and I had already had a glass of wine. And so stupid over stupid over stupid. And I slammed myself on the ground, lost consciousness, woke up in the hospital, you know, but somebody picked me up and took me home with the e-bike, which was Paul Nicklin's brand new e-bike, with my Daytona. And there's this guy called Paul on my phone, using my cell phone, and said, Paul, Christina's been hurt. You need to come home. And he left. So we never knew who this good Samaritan was. And he left the bike and the Rolex on my counter. You know, he took it off because my hand was destroyed and the watch was destroyed. And so I need to send it to be repaired. And I just haven't been home long enough to put it in a box and send it to Rolex.
Wow. Major kudos to the good Samaritan. One, I'm glad you're okay. But two, I had no idea that was the backstory. It, from what I could tell, at least in that episode on Nat Geo, looked like it was a white dial. Maybe it's a Panda. I'm not sure. Rolex Daytona.
And it's a beautiful watch.
Yeah. Well, no, it caught my eye because it's just one, I'm a watch guy, but two, that's cool. So you said you don't like taking your watch off when you dive. So when you dive, do you actually dive with, a Rolex, or do you dive with a dive watch as well as your dive computer?
Yes. So I dive with my watch and I dive with my computer. My computer oftentimes gives me, you know, a lot of information, the depth, you know, how much gas I have, the time to surface, you know, my safety stuff, but it doesn't tell me what time it is. And so
I know.
One of the reasons is because I am partially in charge of feeding the crew. And so I need to keep tabs on things like lunchtime and, you know, how long have those beans been simmering or whatever.
That's awesome. Yeah, no, I have a dive coming up this weekend, so I'm double wristing as well. I've got my Doxa Clive Cussler 300T. But no, I found it interesting when I saw you with your watch because, oh, that's so cool. Is that yellow gold or is that?
It's that rose.
Oh, it's rose gold. Oh, I didn't catch that. I thought it was stainless steel at first when you flashed it. Oh, that's cool.
So, you know, one of the reasons I use this watch is because it has this dial that allows me to see elapsed time, you know, quickly. And sometimes, you know, I want to just know if there's a whale, for example, how long has it been diving for? And I just, you know, set these little time things for myself.
Oh, such a cool collection. Yeah. I believe your children is just north of me. They're in Vancouver and British Columbia, aren't they?
I have three children. My oldest one, who's my stepson, he's a bird watcher. So he's working for the American Bird Conservancy on a project called In Search of the Lost Birds. And so he's going around the world looking for birds that we thought were extinct. So good to follow John Mittermeier. And then Mick, who's my firstborn, lives in Miami, and he's a horticulturist and a botanist, and he collects and grows rare plants. And he describes them for science and sells them. So that's Mick Mitty on Instagram. And then Juliana, my daughter, lives in Victoria. And she works for my business. She manages my photo archive. She manages my newsletter. So three kids. They're all very useful.
Very cool. Well, hopefully if you're ever in my neck of the woods, you have my contact. I'd love to meet with you sometime. That'd be great.
Oftentimes, you know, when we travel to the United States, we cross through Bellingham. So,
now, you know, I'm the host of the Bellingham podcast here for 8-9 years going on. So we should catch up sometime. I know that you are tight on time. So I've got one last question, because I started off, when we started off, like, we're parents, and I'm just curious. So as a role model for many aspiring explorers, just in general, like, I know a lot of adults that absolutely pay homage to you as a photographer and such. How do you encourage and nurture, you know, children into becoming, keeping their adventureness, keeping their explorerness, whether they become an environmentalist or not, but just keeping that nature of being an explorer and being connected to the planet?
You know, if you were to ask a lot of photographers my age, you know, a lot of them would probably say that their parents discouraged them from becoming artists or becoming scientists, because, you know, back in the day, it was very difficult to make a living. But today, I think there's going to be a shift, as I think being a creative human is irreplaceable, is that we can do things that AI will never be able to do. And so I would encourage young people to pursue a career in the creation of, you know, human assets. Whether you want to be an architect or a photographer, you know, these artistic things, it's uniquely our species. So the other thing that I would say is our planet is in a lot of trouble, you know, from so many reasons. And we need storytellers to not just document what's happening, but to remind us why it's important, to help us paint the vision of the planet we want to live in. So we need a lot of storytellers, a lot of photographers out there, especially in the ocean. You know, we know so little about our planet, discovering new species all the time, you know, exploring the ocean. I mean, we know nothing.
Yeah.
So we need a lot of divers with cameras. So.
We need kids with cameras and fins. Stat!
tell us what's there, right?
I feel like, and I think several others have attributed you and Paul to kind of being the reboot of Jacques Cousteau. Like, you guys are Jacques Cousteau 2.0. Do you identify like that? Or is that just people just looking at what you do and being just awe-inspired?
So the thing that Jacques Cousteau did is that he kind of invited us for the first time into a part of our planet that most people don't have access to. And I think that was inspiration, certainly for me. You know, I used to read his books and all, but when I go back now and read his books, like the things that he was doing, oh my God, I mean, first of all, they were eating all the wildlife on board of Calypso. But like, this is, we didn't know any better. There's a whole passage of the Calypso chasing a pod of sperm whales, and they accidentally run over the baby and they have to kill it, you know? So in that sense, no, we're not that kind of Jacques Cousteau.
Right.
I'm very good friends with all of the Cousteau grandchildren. You know, they all share this passion for the planet. Philippe, Celine, Alexandra, they're all amazing. And they are the ones who deserve to be the new Cousteaus. But Paul and I just want to continue the tradition of extending an invitation for people to be curious about the most important ecosystem on planet Earth. This is the ecosystem that sparked life on this planet, and it's the ecosystem that keeps us alive. So we just want to invite people on the adventure of, you know, exploring the ocean.
Well, thank you for taking up my invite for coming on to the show. Before we close out, if you wanted to invite people to come see or to check out Hope or whatever, where can we invite people to see your projects?
So I would like to extend two invitations. One is for people to learn more about Sea Legacy, because I think what we're doing is important. And one of the things we're doing is shining a spotlight on the heroes in the front line, to all these amazing organizations that are finding solutions for all the ocean problems. So that's sealegacy.org. And the second one is to be part of Hope. And you can find more information either on my Instagram, and I am at Mitty, M-I-T-T-Y, or on my website. It's right there on the banner, Christina Mittermeier. Christina has no H, so C-R-I-S-T-I-N-A. And yeah, I mean, I'd love for more people to be part of Hope.
Thank you so much, Christina, for your time. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. This is so much fun, and go diving.
So hopefully you gathered from this episode why I feel that Christina is, one, an amazing human being, but two, an even more powerful storyteller and photographer. I can't thank her enough for taking the time to come on to the Analog Explorer and the Made Under Pressure podcast. It really has been already the highlight of my year. Now, if you found interest in Christina's work or found perhaps hope in her work, go ahead and check out her website, Christina Mittermeier. Remember, there's no H in Christina, C-R-I-S-T-I-N-A, Mittermeier, M-I-T-T-E-R-M-E-I-E-R.com. And at the top of her website, you'll see her new book that she's crowdfunding called Hope. Now, check the show notes for all the references that I mentioned. Check out Sea Legacy. And definitely check out that website before you check out that Nat Geo episode. And that's sealegacy.org. Now, for my friends in the watch fam, hopefully you enjoyed a little bit of the reveal of the backstory of two of the watches that Christina wears on her wrist diving and exploring. Now, if you're interested more on the Analog Explorer side of things, you can read about my analog manifesto, my passion for photography, my love of travel, diving, and watches in print and online at analogexplorer.com. Made Under Pressure is a content extension of Deep Sea Magazine. I'm AJ Barce, the Air Analog Explorer, reminding you to make time to explore. Thanks so much. We'll see you next month.